Actually, what I would like to do today is go back to a couple of previous trips that I made and give you a bit of a news update for the first part of the sermon time that I have today on some interesting things that are going on in other parts of the world. And then I'd like to draw on one of the experiences that we had, that my wife and I had in India just recently, and talk about some things that I believe pertain to all of us in our individual lives as Christians in this time. So I have entitled this Scattered Brethren, and you'll see why as we go through, because many of our brethren are extremely scattered. Even a large congregation in the French-speaking part of the world can be 10 people or 12. That constitutes a pretty sizable congregation. And many times people are so scattered that they have no congregation to attend at all. Okay, before we go any farther, a lot of what I'm going to be showing you is about Africa. So you'll find this interesting, I think. Many people don't realize how large a continent Africa actually is. And so here we have a number of different parts of the world, and you can see the relationship to them inside the African continent. That large orange blob that you see at the bottom, that's China. The brown part that you see in the shoulder of Africa there, that's the United States. The yellow part that you see in the Horn of Africa to the right there, that's India, one of the most populous nations in the world. So this begins to give you, and then you have Western Europe up in the northern part and scattered other parts of the world, just to give you an idea of the scale of the African continent. It is one of the largest of them, and we tend to think of it more in terms of North America, but it's actually much, much larger than North America, certainly as far as habitable areas. So with that as an introduction, let me take you first here to Burundi, where some interesting things have been going on lately. The circle that you see in the middle of the map here is where Bujumbura, the capital, is located. And then up in the northwest, we have Cibitoke province, and that's where God has been very active recently in calling new people. When I began working with this group some years ago, probably 10 or 12 years ago now, there were 60 to 70 people that were attending in three different groups. We now, last year at the feast, had well over 400, and more people are coming steadily. And I'll explain a little bit about some reasons why that's happening. Here's a view of Bujumbura and Lake Tanganyika, which you can see there in the middle. Lake Tanganyika is not a very broad lake. It's not very wide across, necessarily, but it is the second largest lake in the world by volume because it's very deep. In some places, it's 5,000 feet deep, if you can believe that. So it's the second largest lake in the world by volume, and it's actually quite long if you look at it on a map as well. It goes all the way down to Zambia and beyond. The roads are often, the infrastructure is not very good in a lot of places in Africa. They're trying to improve that in Burundi now. It's a challenge. It's one of the poorest countries in the world also, so you see a lot of people walking because you have to be fairly well off even to own a bicycle by local standards. So you see lots and lots of people walking. I don't know how well you can see this, but this gives you an idea of some of the unusual things that you will come across as you travel in sub-Saharan Africa. This was a market day, and these men have just butchered a cow and that they're going to sell in the market, and they don't have any other recipient to carry it in other than the cow's skin. So they butchered it, and they cut it up into pieces, then they just wrapped it up in the skin. They've swung it over the seat of a bicycle, and that they're walking it into the marketplace. So that's what somebody will eat later in the day. People don't have refrigerators. Everything has to be done very fresh. This is the road that leads to our main church hall, which is also our Feast of Tabernacles hall. So judging from the condition of the road, you will understand why I use a four-wheel drive when I go to this area here. And then this is the main hall that we built some years ago, and it can hold more than 400 local people. And this is the hall for the Mugina congregation and also the hall that we use for the Feast of Tabernacles. We were there for the Spring Holy Days. This was the group that gathered on the first day of Unleavened Bread. Not quite 400 people because many people came by, they walked to come here. Some people walked as far as 10 miles one way and 10 miles back home again to be able to attend a service. And one of the reasons that God's granting us a lot of growth here is because of this gentleman on the left. This is Mr. Nathan Mukeshimana, who's our pastor here. And he has a very, very good reputation. He started out as a pastor with the Church of God Seventh Day. And then when he learned about the Holy Days, he contacted us. And he's just set a very fine example. He farms his own ground. He doesn't take any money from the tithes and offerings that are given to the church there. He prefers to earn his own living and then just serve people. And as a result of that, he has a very stellar reputation as someone who knows his Bible well, someone who lives a godly life. And when people hear about that, they're intrigued, and especially when they learn about the Sabbath and the holy days, which more and more people are doing now. So this has gone from under 100 people to probably close to 450 by this Feast of Tabernacles in the space of 10 or 12 years. This was a day of leadership training that my wife and I had with local leaders, both men and women. We now have 7 different congregations that are meeting there, and so it does take leadership on different various levels. And so one of the best uses of our time when we go there is to meet with the leaders and try to up their game, I guess you would say, as far as serving locally. This is my wife taking some photos and showing what an iPhone is like to local people there. That's kind of something out of science fiction. If they knew what science fiction was, that would be from science fiction. And this is the kitchen. This is the way meals are prepared. This was lunch in preparation for those who were attending the leadership seminar that we had. And this is the way, this is actually quite a well-equipped kitchen by local standards. This is the way cooking is done. No electricity. Everything's done over wood and charcoal. Now, I mentioned that we're having some new congregations come along. This is one of them, Gachacha, as you can see here, and they're in the process of building their hall. They didn't have any walls in their little shelter when I was there, and it was explained to me that they had taken up a collection, and they'd been able to come up with 2/3 of the cost of the plot of this land. So they came up with, as I recall, it was $400. They needed $200 more to pay for the piece of land, and the owner said, well, until I get full payment, you can put a roof up, but you can't put any walls in. And so that's where things stood when we visited, and I was happy to be able, on behalf of the church, give them the $200 that they needed to be able to purchase the land and follow through with that. So there was dancing and singing, as there is when they welcome a guest. And then the children really look you over. They don't see light-skinned people there very much. And so we're kind of unpredictable. They don't know what we're going to do. And as I walk through the village, I'll have a trail of these children walking along behind me. And if by chance I happen to turn around, suddenly they all jump. Like, what's it going to do? They don't know if it might be dangerous or not. So they're really checking us out. Here's another one of the new congregations at Rugombo. And mostly their requests have to do with, would you help us obtain, construct, buy a hall where we can be out of the rain during the rainy season. And so that's a lot of the assistance that we give. And we dose it out. We don't give everybody a hall right away. We do one a year or two a year because they need to understand we don't have unlimited means available either. But we do gradually help them. That's something that as a church we want to do, make sure they have a decent place to meet for the Sabbath. Here's the Chibitoke congregation. And I don't know if you can see clearly in the wall behind you there, but there's a door, and then there's a hole in the wall that looks like another door. That's not a door. It's a hole in the wall. Because all of these constructions are simply made out of sun-dried mud brick. And if they get wet, you know what happens to mud when it gets wet. So that's why it's important to have a roof on it, and it takes a lot of maintenance all the time. Same thing with the children. They're checking me out pretty carefully here when I get my camera out. And finally, this is probably the most remote congregation we have anywhere in the world because it's already pretty remote by the time you get up to northwestern Burundi. But this is one of the bridges that you have to cross to get out to this place. I dubbed it the Bridge of Doom because it didn't look very substantial, but we made it in our four-wheel drive. And then finally, we have this congregation here at Kagurutsi. And this is probably the most remote congregation we have anywhere, and yet you can see the size of it. Many, many people way out in the middle of nowhere are coming and attending services on a regular basis on the Sabbath day. So lots and lots of growth here. This is an interesting area where God is calling a lot of people. And it's very obvious to me that this is God's work when I go someplace like this, because I wouldn't even have been able to find this place on a map. This is no strategy that we laid out. Oh, we need to raise up a congregation here in Kagurutsi. No, this is just God's work, and he's calling people here. I'll move over to the Democratic Republic of the Congo now, which I often joke is neither democratic nor a republic, but it's definitely the Congo. This is the Congo River, one of the mightiest rivers in the world. And it's a rather, it's an extremely corrupt place. The corruption level is one of the highest in the world, and the infrastructure needs a lot of work. This is a main street downtown a couple of trips ago. I don't know if they broke a water main or there just wasn't enough drainage, but it turned into a lake, and we had to drive through there to get to where we were going, to the church hall. Lots of things are sold out on the street, just about anything you want to buy and a lot of stuff you don't want to buy. This coffin delivery right to your doorstep if you need that. I hope this is an empty one. I think it is. And this is where we have, this is our church hall. We rent a compound here. We must have a permanent address for the church because, being a dictatorship, the dictator wants to know where he can put his hands on people if they cross him in some way. So in order to function as a church, you must have a permanent address where they know they can find the leadership. So we have rented this house. It's basically just a house with a wall around it, and all the walls in Kinshasa have razor wire on the top of them because there's so much crime. So obviously the name of the church, and then Bible studies during the week. They put the times up when people can come by if they want to. There are power outages every day, so we have solar panels on the roof so that we can have a couple of light bulbs and also a fan. Very important to have a fan. We have services at 9 a.m. in the morning before the hottest part of the day, but we're still, I don't wear a jacket, obviously, but by the end of the service, there's not a dry bit of clothing on my body because the heat and the humidity is so strong here. This is what a church service looks like, very much like what you would expect here. And one of the things we try to do for the 100-plus people that are attending here is provide them a meal when we can, because it's this is also a place where the average person is extremely poor, and they very rarely can eat meat. When I've asked people, you know, on average, and what's the average citizen in Kinshasa, the people you know, how often do they eat meat? And they will say once or twice a year. That's basically what it was. In fact, a couple of years ago, I was going over, for the leaders, I was going over the laws on clean and unclean meat, among other fundamental doctrines of the church. And when they got to insects, somebody asked me about caterpillars. And I said, well, no, that's not clean. And one man got very upset. He said, what are we supposed to do for protein? And very sadly, that's what many people in Kinshasa will eat. They buy caterpillars, they chop them up, and they fry them kind of like mushrooms, and that's the only animal protein that poor people can afford. So anyway, all that to say, when we go, we offer them a meal, because many of them have come, they've walked a long way to get there, or they have used about a dollar one way, each way, to get to church, and most people only live on about a dollar or so a day in the area here, maybe two, so that's a huge investment on their part. The least we can do is offer them a meal. So that's what we do. Ask them what they would like to have. They pick out local delicacies. The dumplings that you see on the right, that's called fufu. And then what you can see on the plates there are chicken, fish, a little bit of chicken, a little bit of fish, and a spinach-like leafy green. So this is that doesn't look very appetizing to me, but to them it's a real feast. They made short work of it. And let me see if I can... Would you, the technician back there, would you click on the center of this slide? I think I have some video here. I'm not sure I can do it from where I am. Click on the center panel here. Let's see if it will animate for us. Okay, that didn't work. Anyway, what that was just people eating and children sharing a bowl, all eating out of the same bowl, as you can see there. And then another thing that we do, I also had some animation here, but I won't attempt it because the machine's turning it sideways. But I brought in this time a half of suitcase full of old used eyeglasses. And again, these are things that local members cannot really afford. So what we do is we lay them out on a table, and then people can come up and they just try different pairs of glasses. We can't do prescriptions, obviously, but they'll try, they'll hold a Bible out, and they'll see which pair of glasses allows them to read. And so this is something that we try to do. I've already had a request from Cameroon for my next trip. They're requesting a half a suitcase full of eyeglasses, and I have boxes and boxes of them that people have contributed that I have in storage at the at our headquarters office. So when I'm able to do that, I do take in just a lot of old eyeglasses, something that we take for granted. You probably have, if you wear glasses, you have a bunch of pairs laying around the house. But to them, that's something that they just wouldn't be able to have otherwise. Another good thing that happened on my recent trip is I was able to baptize these nine people, most of whom I had been working with for more than a year. Baptized them in the Congo River. And I always ask before baptizing in African rivers, I ask the local people, have there been sightings of hippos or crocodiles in the river here recently? And they tell me no. In this case, Stanley Falls are just back behind here, and neither crocodiles nor hippos like waterfalls. So we were safe. So we were able to baptize these nine new members of the body of Christ. A lot of what I do, again, I mentioned leadership training. That's what's happening here. Get together with the local leaders, answer their questions, give them some training. I'm the second one from the left there if you're having trouble picking me out. Now, here's another interesting situation, and I would like to ask you if you wouldn't mind to remember this in your prayers. This is Musalu Kise and Sima Sima, and these were new gentlemen associated with the church. But they have come from, you see where these stars are on the map. The circle is where the capital of Kinshasa is located. The stars that you see represent small little groups that have, through word of mouth, found out about the church and have been in contact with our leaders in Kinshasa. And they want to be a part of Kagwa. The problem is that the three on the right are in the middle of a war zone. There's an active war going on there right now. The one on the left is called Kikwit, the farthest left star there. And it is possible to go there by road. They finally finished that little bit of infrastructure. But the other ones are in an open state of warfare. The two young people that you see in the lower right were United Nations investigators who are investigating stories of mass graves because of mass killings in this warfare, and they were both murdered on assignment. So what do we do? How are we going to serve these people? My answer is, I don't know. We're looking to find out what can we do. It's certainly not safe for me to try to go in there. It would be a multi-day expedition, which would include hollowed out tree trunks on rivers and motorcycles through the jungle, and that's what it takes to get into some of these places. It's not safe for me to do that, nor can we easily move 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 people into Kinshasa to have a meeting with them. So at the moment, I don't see a way forward for us. We're going to try to bring some of the leaders out at least next time I go there to have some meetings with them. But your prayers would be appreciated that God would make clear the way forward for us, because it's exciting that we have new people that want to come, but when we can't access them or can't reach them, it really puts a twist on things. So this is the congregation in Kinshasa, more than 100 people, and I know they would appreciate being remembered in your prayers. And my wife and I had the chance to accompany David Baker for about 10 days in a trip through India, and we met several these are the places where we have church members now, where these stars are. The two stars right in the middle, just below where the line is, that's where Delhi is. Those are not actually places where we have members, but places where we visited some local bits of interest. But the other stars that you see there are places where we have church brethren. This is what Delhi looks like from the air as you fly in, unbelievably concentrated. India is online to become the most populous nation in the world in about 20 years. It's going to pass China if everything continues as right now. It's a real mix of old and new when you get into Delhi and New Delhi. This is the Red Fort of Delhi, which is World Heritage Site. This was one of the seats of the Mughal Empire. The Mughals were actually Mongols who came down from Mongolia and conquered India, much of India, and then intermarried with the local population. So to differentiate them from the Mongols, history has dubbed them the Mughals, and they basically ruled over India, their emperors did, for about 200 years until they were displaced by the British Empire. And they had some pretty impressive architecture. This is from the 1600s. This was the Maharaja's palace. Because of the heat, they didn't enclose things fully. They would leave them open and hang tapestries or rugs over the openings, and then they could reconfigure them as they wished to. This is the site where Mohandas Gandhi was assassinated. That's become a shrine now in Delhi. He's kind of considered the father of the country. And this was quite interesting from a biblical and a prophetic point of view. This was the residence of the British viceroy. For about 200 years, the King of England was the Emperor of India. And communications being what it was back in the 1700s or so, 1800s, they actually had a viceroy. Vice means like vice president. He was the viceroy, roy meaning that's the French word for king. So he sat in place of the king and ruled over India on behalf of the kings of England. And of course, when India was turned over to its own independence in 1947, the British left, and this is now the residence of the President of India. So it's called the President's House now. But this was built by the British during the period called the Raj, when India was the jewel and the crown of the British Empire, and that has all gone away now. So here we are heading out toward the town of Moradabad. You see some interesting things along the road. Moradabad is the place where we have most of our church members. I dubbed this the Mad Max truck. You see all sorts of interesting things on the roads in India. And all different kinds of transportation. This is just along the side of the road on a highway that we're traveling. So you can go by cow power. You can go by horse power. You can go by camel power. can even go by elephant power. And these are all things that we saw pretty frequently along the side of the road as we traveled around the larger Delhi area. At one point, we crossed over the Ganges River, which is sacred to Hinduism. Ritual purification requires that you take a dip, that you bathe in the Ganges, and it's extremely dirty. It's very polluted. People leave just garbage just floating around in it, and it didn't seem to bother anybody when we went there. They were all happily splashing around in it. We asked our driver, who was a Hindu, if he'd bathed in the Ganges. He had a little bit more education. He said, "Yes, I do, but I go to a cleaner place." So here's a lady offering incense to one of the idols there. And there are idols everywhere. They do have McDonald's, believe it or not. McDonald's can be found, and Burger King can be found. However, when you look closely at the menu, you'll notice there are no two all-beef patties. You just don't find that. This sign at McDonald's says, "Beef and pork products are not sold here." Hindus will not eat beef. It's sacred to them. Muslims, of course, don't eat pork. But they will both eat chicken. So you actually can have you can have a chicken burger at McDonald's, but no beef burgers. Now, this is Moradabad, which is where most of our church members live, and it's a very interesting story. Moradabad is a place that is largely Muslim, and the neighborhood where most of our church members live, it was just sort of open countryside when they moved there and built their house. But it gradually got built up and more, and now it's very densely populated, and it is 100% Muslim. Except for them. There's this one little school in the middle of this overwhelmingly Muslim area, and that's where our church brethren are. They run a school. All of the students are Muslim except their son. He's the only non-Muslim student in a school of 300. And they're feeling the tension, the religious tension, very clearly now. They don't feel safe allowing their children to play outside in the street. They must be with them at all times. They cannot leave the house because something bad could happen to them because there is so much tension. In this kind of persecution, and I'm going to call it that, this is a group, this is the largest group of members that we have in India. Robinson Yusuf and his wife, Dayamani, have two children who are now adults, Eugene and Rachel. Eugene is married. He and his wife, Deepti, have two children, Jennifer and Rex. Rachel is not married, but they all live together. That whole family live together in this house. Then there's another family belonging to Anil Dockland, and they are nearby, and they also come here for services. So we met with them. The current government in India is very outspokenly Hindu. Up until now, they've tried to keep things nonpartisan in the country to keep the peace, but Mr. Modi's government is really militantly Hindu. And so they are reducing the rights and privileges of both Christians and Muslims. 85% of the country is Hindu, about 10% is Muslim, and the other 5% is everything else. You've got Buddhists, you've got other things, and you've got Christians. So you can imagine Christians are just a few percentage points of the population, and they're feeling this very intense pressure on them. I'll talk more about that in a moment as well. They're feeling this pressure both from Hindus, and they're feeling it also from the Muslims in the nation. Many of the, probably aware that India has a caste system. There are 5 castes. And then outside of the caste system, there are people known as untouchables. There's sometimes people talk about them being a caste, but they're not. They're outside the caste system, and they are the outcasts. They are untouchables, and they're given the jobs that nobody else wants to do, the really dirty jobs. Well, as you can imagine, many of those people have converted to Christianity, which teaches that we're all equal. The Bible does that. You can understand why they would do that, and many of them have become very faithful Christians, at least as the world understands that. But what this has also meant is that to Hindus, untouchable and Christian has become the same thing. So Christianity now is an untouchable language, and it's the lowest of the low. And so there's a lot of persecution being felt by Christians. And this group told us stories of how difficult it is, how they always feel like they're on a knife's edge. They realize that probably someday they're going to have to leave, and they're preparing themselves just to walk away from this school that they've spent decades building because they wouldn't be able to get a fair price for it. Who is willing to pay full price for a school when they know that sooner or later they're probably just going to have to walk away from it? So they're prepared to lose basically everything they've spent their adult lives building up. They're preparing themselves mentally for that, if that's required. But they said, God has watched over us thus far. We believe he will continue to care for us. So this is Diamani. This is Deepti in the background there and with her kitchen. We had lunch and dinner with them that they prepared. This is their courtyard. They showed us the monkey stick. That's a long rod that they use to poke monkeys to get them out of the courtyard because monkeys are all over India and they can make quite a mess. So here we have three generations of members in the Church of God. And here I am giving a Bible study, showing them photos of members in other places in the world. God's people are always interested in what's going on in the lives of their brethren. Heads up, I brought my camera with me today. I'm going to take some photos after services because they want to know what's going on in your life, and they want to know what's going on here in the United States. So if you don't mind, if you see me with the camera, smile, or if you just don't want to be in a photo, turn around. But I'm showing you their pictures. They want to see your pictures. And so here we are during the Bible study that I gave. And then we had the chance during the week to look around at a couple of other interesting places like Agra, which was another seat of the Mughal Empire. This is David Baker, who's our regional director for Asia. You hear from me from time to time on In Accord because I work out of the headquarters office. Mr. Baker does not, and so we don't know as much about what he does. And one of the reasons that we were going around with him was so I could take photos and shoot some video of him. So we hope to be able to highlight more work that other men are doing who travel on behalf of the church. Some of us you hear about fairly frequently, as I said, because we're in the office, but there are others who travel just as much, about which we don't hear nearly as much. And so we're trying to work on broadening that coverage. This was one of the thrones of the Mughal Empire, and the white spot that you can see on the horizon in the background, that's the Taj Mahal. And this throne here was out in the open. You have to imagine it covered with sumptuous pillows and tapestries, and that was one of the thrones of the Mughal Empire. The white spot that you see on the lower left was from a British cannonball when the British finally conquered the Mughal Empire and replaced it. The Taj Mahal is one of those places that's every bit as beautiful as what you would imagine. It really is a stunning place. We went early in the morning before the big rush of crowds came, and that's extremely memorable for us. Jaipur is another really interesting place, another royal Mughal center. The Amer Palace, it's World Heritage Sites, these are very famous. Here's Mr. Baker making his arrival, suitable transportation to the palace. And one of the palaces of the Maharaja, very opulent. At one point, the richest man in the world was an Indian Maharaja. He was wealthier than all of the crowned heads of Europe, to give you an idea of how much wealth there was here. And the richest man in the world for quite a long time was the Maharaja of Hyderabad here, which is a place where we have a couple of other members. King George the Fifth, I believe it was, when he came to India to be crowned or to have his ceremony of investiture as the Emperor of India, he stayed with his friend who was the Maharaja of Hyderabad. And the Maharaja was richer than the King of England at the time, even though he owed him allegiance. And here we have two sisters, Arjumand and Nargis Ali. They are daughters of the first converted member of the church in India. Dr. Ali, their mother, died just a few years ago, but she had quite a fascinating story as well. She was married to a Muslim, and when she converted to Christianity, he began to persecute her to the point of physically harming her. So she had to leave the house, but by law, children stay with the father under Muslim law, and so the daughters had to stay with their father until he died, and then they were able to return and go with their mother. And they were so impressed with her example of grace under fire, so to speak, that they decided they wanted to know more about that. And they are now members of the church, longtime members, and very faithful. But they also told us stories of persecution. Just recently, they were denied several apartments that they wanted to rent because in the process of discussion with the landowner or the landlord, he would eventually get around to asking them what religion they were. And when they said they were Christians, he said, "I'm sorry, I'm only renting to Hindus." And so they were denied a number of apartments. This is something they said has never happened in the past, that this wasn't a question that was asked in their lifetime. But now this pressure is mounting. It's growing, and they're feeling it very palpably. And they said it was quite shocking to them and troubling to them. They also don't know what the future holds, but they know that it's looking more and more difficult for the Christian minority in India. A little bit about Rwanda. also here. These are four volunteers for an FOI, Foundation Outreach International project in Rwanda. Sharon Mundo on the left is a dentist from Guatemala. We have Brandon Burrow, who's just a recent high school graduate from North Carolina. Greg Schwartz is a dentist by profession, also an elder in the church. And Jessica Schultz is a school teacher. And so the two dentists went to provide dental care to our brethren there, and also to help local dentists improve their skill set. And then Jessica and Brandon gave basic English courses to those who signed up for them. We had a class of 30. This is Dr. Schwartz giving a split sermon. And then during the week, we rented this conference center from an order of nuns. And so that's why if you see one of the students here wearing a habit, you don't need to call the doctrine committee. She just asked if she could join in. She's a midwife, and she felt having some rudiments of English would improve her skills. So we were happy to include her in the classes. They brought a lot of material over. The students were very interested and attentive. And so there was lots of conversational English. They learned a little bit of reading. It was just a basis, about as good a basis you can get in a week. Rwanda recently changed by law its European language. Most African countries will have local languages and then one dominant European language for use in education. And up until just recently, it was French in Rwanda. But the Rwandan government has changed that to English now. And so anybody who has even rudimentary English, that's a big leg up to finding work or getting ahead. So that's why this was so useful to many of the church members who were very, very thankful to have these classes available to them. This is Mrs. Mondelli, our pastor's wife in Rwanda, and she was thrown this beach ball with different English words on it, and whatever word was on top, that's what she had to do, stand, sit, walk, run, one of the exercises that was given there. Here they are using fly swatters to point out the correct word. And we got our signals crossed on this one. This was supposed to be a game of telephone, you know, where one person whispers to the next person, but everybody was listening to everybody here, so. It's hard when you don't really have a language in common. Sometimes it's hard to give very precise directions. But all these people here that you see in the photo, all these people were able to have this week-long series of classes. Meanwhile, our two dentists were providing free dental care for our church members and for other local Rwandans who had particularly difficult cases to be treated. And Dieudonné, the young man that you see in the back there, he was scholarshiped by the church all through his education. He's now a dental assistant, very responsible and a good job. And that's thanks to the support that the church gave to him and his family, basically until he finished his diploma. And there are other young people who are now have very good jobs as a result of educational scholarships that the church has provided for the last 20 years. So lots of happy people. We also provide a meal for them. Most Rwandans only eat one really big meal a day. And although we provided two, old habits die hard. So those plates are heaping because they say in Rwanda sometimes, well, in a lot of Africa they say eat up because you don't know when you're going to eat again. And in some cases that's really true. So it was quite amazing to see. I thought they were violating the laws of physics at time with how much they were able to put on there, but they managed to do it. So all of these are church members who received dental care, and then there were many others who were treated by our dentist as well. We have one baptism, second man from the right there. And these are your church brethren in Rwanda. And again, some of the poorest church members that we have any place in the world. Most of them are just subsistence farmers. We did take our volunteers out for one night at a game park, just a couple of hours outside of Kigali. So there were plenty of zebras and hippos, and this was the first time to go out and see these animals for most of our volunteers, so they really enjoyed it. It's a very beautiful game park, game area. Those are hippos in the background, and there's no fence there at all, so the guide said, you can go out as far as the rocks to have your pictures taken, but look over your shoulder once in a while, and if you see the hippos heading toward you, run, they said. So I don't think that was actually necessary to say that, but anyway. So these are your brethren in Rwanda, and I just want you to know that you have helped participate in making this project possible. By being a part of the Church of God, by being a part of this association, you're helping do a lot of good, not only spiritually, but even physically in the lives of many of your church brethren in other parts of the world. Okay, we can pull that screen up now. I'm done with my slides. But I would like to come back and talk to you now with the time we have left on the sermon here and talk about the topic of persecution, because we were very struck, my wife and I, by the situation of our brethren in India who are really facing open persecution. Now, we're facing sort of closed persecution, I guess you would say, or indirect persecution, because Christianity is mocked increasingly in our Western world, in the United States, and there have been law judgments against people who are simply trying to be true to their own biblical beliefs or their own beliefs. But persecution is coming, and the Bible actually says there's a time of stronger persecution that's yet ahead. So I'd like for us to think about what's going on with our brethren in India, and I'd also like for us to think about what we may have ahead of us in the next few years. The Supreme Court recently got involved, didn't it, in this case of the baker who didn't want to bake a cake for a wrong sexual relationship. And the Supreme Court corrected that, but only by one voice. What would it take for that situation to flip once again? Wouldn't take very much. And we can imagine that that's what's going to happen in the future. Turn with me to 2 Timothy chapter 3, if you would, please. 2 Timothy 3. Second Timothy chapter 3, verse 10. Paul writes to Timothy here, he says, "You have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, persecutions, afflictions which happened to me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra, what persecutions I endured." He mentioned that several times. Paul knew what persecution was about. "The persecutions I endured, and out of them all the Lord delivered me." Verse 12 says, "Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution." Now, persecution can be of various levels of gravity. And probably you can think of some time in your life when you've faced some opposition because of what you believe. Maybe it's a family member making fun of you. Maybe it's your boss who doesn't want to give you time off for a holy day. We probably all have had to face some of that. And we should understand that this is, it's a given for Christians. We're going to face opposition. We're going to face sometimes dramatic opposition from people who are going to pressure us to knuckle under and go with the flow of the world in which we live. It's going to happen to all of us at some time. And in fact, that's always been the case for God's servants. If you'll turn with me to Acts chapter 7, Acts chapter 7, we'll read something that Stephen said just before he was persecuted to death. Acts chapter 7, verse 52. So this is Stephen's sermon, his last sermon. Acts chapter 7, verse 52. He said to the crowd that was getting more and more angry with him because of the truths he was telling them, "Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute?" Now, if you think about what that means for a moment, that means every single prophet of God who worked was persecuted. Every single one faced persecution because of the message that God gave them to give. "And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you have now become the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it." Every single one of the prophets was persecuted. And we can imagine just about every single person that God used down through the years faced persecution. Well, let's try to define that term a little bit so we know exactly what we're talking about. Persecuted or persecution in the New Testament is the Greek word dioko. Dioko. And dioko means to put to flight, to make someone run away. That's what persecution attempts to do. So it means to put to flight, by implication to persecute, to press, to pursue, to run after, to seek after. There's an expression that we use often in English today. We talk about somebody coming after me. Yeah, he just came after me. Well, that's kind of what persecution means. That's one way that we could sum it up. It's somebody coming after you to do you harm or to make you do what they want you to do. Other definitions include to systematically oppress or harass. That's another way of summing up persecution. Systematically oppress and harass. It can mean also, according to the Holman Illustrated Bible Dictionary, to intimidate, to silence, to punish, and in the gravest of cases, to kill. So it can mean anything from harassment from family members who maybe take a mocking tone when they talk about what we do. It can mean oppression at work when your boss just doesn't want to let you have time off for the holy days. It can talk about making teachers who give young people a hard time when they're going to leave for the Feast of Tabernacles. I had a high school teacher who gave me a hard time about that one time. I remember it very clearly. It can mean condemnation before civil authorities, like that cake maker. He's being persecuted because of his beliefs. That is persecution. And in the worst case, as I said, it can mean people being put to death, as many of our predecessors in the faith were, because of their beliefs. It's interesting to note that because it means coming after someone or harassing someone, Jesus even said that Paul, or Saul as he was then, was persecuting him. Remember that? In Acts chapter 9, verse 4, I won't turn there, I'll just read it to you. It says, Saul fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he said, Who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. Paul, Saul, was going after Jesus. He was trying to intimidate people to draw them away or drive them away from Jesus Christ. So it's interesting that that's the word that was used of Saul's action toward Jesus. He was persecuting him. He was going after him. Let's look at a few other things the Bible says about that. John chapter 15. John 15. Verse 20. John chapter 15, verse 20. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But to all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me. Some people did believe on Christ's word. Not many. After 3.5 years of the Son of God himself preaching and doing amazing miracles, 120 people believed on that day of Pentecost, and then a few thousand more. Not very many. So we shouldn't expect that there are going to be hundreds of thousands of people who hear or heed the word today. It's always been a small group, the ones who have responded to God's calling. But Jesus said, if they have persecuted me, and they did, they will persecute you. It comes with the package of being a Christian. Mark chapter 10. Let's look at something else Jesus said about persecution. Mark chapter 10. Verse 29. Kind of interesting how he says this here. Jesus answered and said, Assuredly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel's who shall not receive a hundredfold now in this time, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands. Up to that point it's pretty good. But then he adds, with persecutions. That comes with the package. There's a wonderful family that we find, spiritually speaking, wonderful relationships, friendships that are closer than brothers and sisters in many cases. But along with that comes, at times, persecutions. And notice how this is connected immediately. Persecution is connected with something else. Persecutions, and in the life to come, eternal life. That's an interesting connection that we're going to come back to. The Bible seems to underline this connection between facing persecution successfully and the reward that God holds out to us in the future. Facing opposition, facing harassment, facing intimidation, facing even punishment because we follow the Christian way, that's part of being a follower of Jesus Christ. And it's linked to the reward that he promises, that he holds out to us. Well, let's ask a question now. What might we expect in the future? It says we're going to face persecution. Well, judging from some things that happened in the past, everything that's in the Bible was written for our instruction. Maybe we can look at what kinds of persecutions happened in the past and project ourselves forward and see if we might expect something like that in the future. One example happens in Acts chapter 8. Acts chapter 8, verse 1. Acts chapter 8, verse 1. Saul was consenting to his death, Stephen's death, and at that time a great persecution arose against the church, which was at Jerusalem. So this was fairly localized, this persecution. Jerusalem simply became too hot for Christians to remain there. And they were scattered, they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. God worked it out for them to be able to remain, gave them some extra protection so they could stay there. But everyone else had to get out of town. Now, they didn't have to go very far in this case. Judea, Samaria, that's a day's walk. They just had to get out of Jerusalem. This was a fairly localized thing here. But that's something that perhaps we could foresee in the future. It might come a time when certain areas would just be too dangerous for us to stay. We might have to get out of town for a while. We might have to go someplace safer. This is something that our church brethren in India are already thinking about. We may just have to get out of here. This whole area could become too dangerous for us to remain here with our children. We might just have to leave. Now, I hope as we go through these things and we're trying to think about maybe some scenarios, we're looking at possibilities that might happen in the future. One reason I think it's important for us to do this is that we need to prepare ourselves mentally in advance. It's good for us to think about these things, realize what's happened to our brethren in the past, what some of our predecessors in the faith have had to do, what some of our brethren in other parts of the world may be facing in the short term, and we need to think about it in our own lives. How would I react if something like that happened? What would my response be? Would I respond with faith and confidence in God? Or would it be a real trial? Would it be a real difficulty that I might have a hard time surmounting? I think it's good for us to think about these things in advance so that we can decide this is how I'm going to do my best to respond to that if it happens. Let's look at another example in Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13, verse 49. Acts chapter 13, verse 49. The word of the Lord was being spread throughout all the region, but the Jews stirred up the devout and prominent women and the chief men of the city. They raised up persecution against Paul and Barnabas and expelled them from their region. But they shook off the dust from their feet against them and came to Iconium, and the disciples were filled with joy and with the Holy Spirit. That's kind of an odd reaction, isn't it? You just got run out of town on a rail. The police are expelling you from town and they're rejoicing. How can that be? Well, hold that thought. We'll come back to it in just a moment. But let's think about what it says here. Let's look at this in more detail. The Jews stirred up prominent women and the chief men of the city, and they raised up a persecution against them. See, what we have here is not a mob action. This is not the mob that's getting incited. These are prominent people in the community. These are respected leaders in the community, women and men, apparently working in the background. Doesn't say they're going to the Roman authorities and accusing them of having broken some law. It's just a campaign to get them out. They were convincing people that Christianity was a menace to society. Maybe they did lean on the authorities. You need to get these men out. They're causing trouble here. They're causing dissension in our city, and they need to be expelled. Could we imagine something like that happening in a future not too far off? Prominent people making accusations, courts, activist judges getting involved and making judgments about what is wrong and what is right. I mentioned the example of a baker who refused his creative services to bake a cake for the celebration of homosexual events. So sell them on the end of a kind of cake that they wanted, but he just wouldn't use his artistic talents to celebrate that. And he had his livelihood threatened. In fact, if the Supreme Court hadn't intervened, he would have had his livelihood destroyed. His business that he took years to build up would have simply been destroyed. And as I said, it just was one vote. That was one vote. That's how close it came. Can we imagine something like that happening, where there would be intense pressure from those who want to be our intellectual leaders in the country? I think that's very easy to imagine. A campaign, a whispering campaign, or a slander campaign against Christians, against the Bible. These things are already happening, and I believe we can expect it to get worse in the future. What's our reaction going to be to that? How will we respond to that situation if it arises? A third example is found in Luke 21, Luke chapter 21. Verse 12. Luke chapter 21, verse 12. This is the parallel passage to Matthew 24, so signs of the times just before the return of Jesus Christ. Before all these things, Jesus said, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will send some of you to your death, and you will be hated of all nations for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost, and your patience possess your souls. Again, let's slow this down a little bit, and let's try to imagine what's happening here. This doesn't appear to be a prophecy for every single member of the church. If we see how this played out in the past, this was what happened to the apostles, or recognizable leaders in the church. The leaders were dragged before the authorities, and some of them were imprisoned, as was the case with the Apostle Paul. And so I think this is likely to be a situation that would happen in the future. It's not every single church member who's going to be dragged before the courts necessarily or put in prison, but some of the recognizable leadership in the church might be. They would be choice targets, no doubt. Arrest, prosecution, that's not hard to imagine something like that happening, especially in the light of what's going on in the legal system already in this country. Perhaps some of our more visible leaders could be the targets of mob violence. We've seen supposedly respected politicians in the last few weeks, you've seen that in the news, where they're telling their followers to get on people. You call them out. Don't let them have a meal in a restaurant. Harass them. Harass them wherever they go. Threaten their children. That's stuff that's already going on in the United States. It's not hard to imagine that something like that could be directed against leaders in the church. What would our response to that be? How would our response to that be if someone that we know, someone in the leadership of the church, is arrested and accused with some spurious accusation? It would be easy to be ashamed or to sort of cower or pull away from that. What would our reaction be in a situation like that? It's happened before. It could easily happen again. Something to think about. Let me ask one more question before we finish up. And that is, does the Bible give us any pointers on how we should respond if we face persecution? What should our response be if we confront some of these situations of persecution in the future? Well, one thing we should do, or rather not do, is found in Romans chapter 8. Let's look at that. Romans chapter 8. Verse 35. Romans chapter 8, verse 35. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or, there's our word, persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? As it is written, for your sake we are killed all day long, we are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Well, that's one thing we must be on our guard about, and that is not to doubt the love of God when we suffer. When we face persecution, that does not mean God has ceased loving us, or caring for us, or watching over us. And that is difficult for human beings. When we suffer, the first thing we want to know is why. What did I do to deserve this? I've been faithful all these years, and now this is happening to me. It doesn't seem fair. We all have a very pronounced sense of fairness, of what fairness, what's fair and what's not fair. Children start telling their parents that at a very young age, right? That's not fair. She got more ice cream than I did. It's easy for us to do that. But we must not doubt the love of God when we suffer. Even when we face persecution, God still loves us. He's still in charge of what happens. His people being willing to face opposition in order to be faithful to him and to follow his will has always been a part of his plan. And it remains so today. It will be so tomorrow. We must think in advance about these things so that we prepare ourselves for it, so that we have already made a mental decision in our mind. I understand that persecution may come. And I know that doesn't mean God has stopped loving me, or that he's no longer watching out for me, or that I'm no longer under his care. We can't doubt the love of God. We can't doubt his mastery of all situations. We can't doubt that his plan is being perfectly fulfilled, and that it will have the happiest of happy endings if we see it through to the end. Let's look at something else. Other advice the Bible gives us about facing persecution. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. 1 Corinthians 4. Verse 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 11. Paul, writing to the Corinthian church, said, "Even to the present hour we both hunger and thirst. We are poorly clothed. We are beaten and homeless. And we labor, working with our own hands." And here's how Paul responded to persecution. "Being reviled, we bless. Being persecuted, we endure it. Being defamed, we entreat. We ask kindly. We respond gently. We have been made as the filth of the world, the offscouring of all things until now." Being persecuted, we endure. Being reviled, we bless. That's not going to be an easy thing to do. But basically what this means is we still have to be Christians. We still have to set a good Christian example, even when we're being treated very unfairly. We still have to turn the other cheek in the face of whatever happens. That was the example that Paul quoted his own example there, because he's telling the Corinthians that's what you should do as well. That's the way we're supposed to act as Christians. This is the most powerful witness that people can give, because it is the hardest to do. When you are spitefully treated, when you're treated very unfairly, when someone is treating you just miserably and you respond with Christian grace, that is a striking example. And it is perhaps in those moments when we face persecution that we will have the opportunity to give the most remarkable, noticeable, striking example of God living in us. That's the whole idea of martyrdom, of witnesses. They show in their flesh that they're willing to go a different way. They will put up with unfairness and they respond with grace under pressure. That's a very striking example. That's why we read what we read in Acts chapter 5, when it talks about, well, we already read one example where after they were kicked out of the city, they were rejoicing. How can you do that? How can you rejoice after you've been used like that? And we read in Acts chapter 5, verse 40, again, I'll just read it to you. "They agreed with him when they had called for the apostles and beaten them. They commanded that they should not speak in the name of Jesus, and they let them go." They beat them. "So they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name." Again, I ask, how does that work? You've been beaten, and you go away rejoicing because you were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name? Why would anybody rejoice in something like that? I believe, brethren, it's because it is at that moment when their example was most powerful. God had given them an opportunity to be shining examples of Christianity in a very difficult circumstance. It was, in fact, I guess you could say, a vote of confidence from God. You are up to this. I know you're up to this, or I wouldn't ask you to do it. So I'm giving you the chance to strike a mighty blow for the fulfillment of my plan. Facing persecution is a sign of God's trust and confidence in us. He won't give us a trial we can't bear. So if we have a really difficult one, it's God trusting us to do it right. And thirdly and finally, Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Verse 11 and 12. Matthew chapter 5, verse 11 and 12. I'm sorry, let's take verse 10. We'll get to 11 and 12 in a moment. Matthew 5, verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I already pointed that out in a previous verse that we read. There's a close connection between persecution and the reward that God holds out to us. And we see that here again. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They will be richly rewarded for what they have gone through in order to be faithful to God. So it's important for us in the face of persecution to focus on the connection between facing that persecution and the reward that God holds out to us, what he has in store. When we're faithful in the face of persecution, our reward grows. It grows. Sometimes athletes say, no pain, no gain. And I believe there's an element of truth to that in Christianity as well. No pain, no gain. The way to the reward that God wants to give us is through facing difficult things. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17 and 18, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Yes, it's hard now. Sometimes it's very hard. But there's no comparison with what God holds out to us. Matthew chapter 5, verse 11. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice when that happens and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. We're taking our place in a long line of people who are faithful and submissive servants of God. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. You're following in a long line of people who set a very good example when they face persecution. Our brethren in India are facing some persecution today. They know that there will be more of it in the future, and certainly worse. It's good for us to think about these things in advance, brethren, so that we can be prepared mentally as much as possible, emotionally as much as we can, and spiritually as much as we can for the persecution that we will face one day, whether it be low level or high level. With the help that God makes available to us, we can meet that challenge and we can succeed. Because Jesus said, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.